Section 4. An Anatomy of Killing. All Factors Considered. The starting point for the understanding of war is the understanding of human nature. S.L.A. Marshall, Men Against Fire. Chapter 1. The Demands of Authority. Milgram and the Military. Quote, "Riflemen miss if orders sound unsure. They only are secure who seem secure." Kingsley Amis, The Masters. Dr. Stanley Milgram's famous studies at Yale University on obedience and aggression found that in a controlled laboratory environment, more than 65% of his subjects could be readily manipulated into inflicting a seemingly lethal electrical charge on a total stranger. The subjects sincerely believed that they were causing great physical pain, but despite their victims' pitiful pleas for them to stop, 65% continued to obey orders, increase the voltage, and inflict the shocks until long after the screams stopped and there could be little doubt that their victim was dead. Prior to beginning his experiments, Milgram asked a group of psychiatrists and psychologists to predict how many of his subjects would use the maximum voltage on their victims. They estimated that a fraction of 1% of the subjects would do so. They, like most people, really don't have a clue, until Milgram taught us this lesson about ourselves. Freud warned us to never underestimate the power of the need to obey. And this research by Milgram, which has since been replicated many times in half a dozen different countries, validates Freud's intuitive understanding of human nature. Even when the trappings of authority are no more than a white lab coat and a clipboard, this is the kind of response that Milgram was able to elicit. I observed a mature and initially poised businessman enter the laboratory, smiling and confident. Within 20 minutes, he was reduced to a twitching, stuttering wreck, who was rapidly approaching a point of nervous collapse. At one point, he pushed his fist into his forehead and muttered, "Oh God, let's stop it." And yet he continued to respond to every word of the experimenter and obeyed to the end. If this kind of obedience could be obtained with a lab coat and a clipboard by an authority figure who has been known for only a few minutes, how much more would the trappings of military authority and months of bonding accomplish? The Demands of Authority. Quote, "The mass needs, and we give it, leaders who have the firmness and decision of command proceeding from habit and an entire faith in their unquestionable right to command, as established by tradition, law, and society." Ardant Dupique, Battle Studies. Someone who has not studied the matter would underestimate the influence of leadership in enabling killing on the battlefield. But those who have been there know better. A 1973 study by Krantz, Kaplan, and Krantz investigated the factors that made a soldier fire. They found that the individuals who had no combat experience assumed that being fired upon would be the critical factor in making them fire. However, veterans listed being told to fire as the most critical factor. More than a century ago, Ardant Dupique found the same thing in his study based on a survey of military officers. He noted one incident during the Crimean War in which, during heavy fighting, two detachments of soldiers suddenly met unexpectedly face to face at 10 paces. They stopped, thunderstruck, then, forgetting their rifles, threw stones and withdrew. The reason for this behavior, according to Dupique, was that neither of these two groups had a decided leader. Authority factors. But it is more complex than the simple influence of orders by a leader. There are many factors in the relationship between the potential killer and the authority that influenced the decision to kill. In Milgram's experiments, the demands of authority were represented by an individual with a clipboard and a white lab coat. This authority figure stood immediately behind the individual who was inflicting shocks and directed that he increase the voltage each time the victim answered a question incorrectly. When the authority figure was not personally present but called over a phone, the number of subjects who were willing to inflict a maximum shock dropped sharply. This process can be generalized to combat circumstances and operationalized into a number of subfactors: proximity of the authority figure, respect for the authority figure, intensity of the authority figure's demands, and the authority figure's legitimacy. Proximity of the authority figure to the subject. Marshall noted many specific World War II incidents in which almost all soldiers would fire their weapons while their leaders observed and encouraged them in a combat situation. But when the leaders left, the firing rate immediately dropped to 15 to 20%. Killer's subjective respect for the authority figure. To be truly effective, killers must bond to their leader, just as they must bond to their group. Shallet noted a 1973 Israeli study that shows that the primary factor in ensuring the will to fight is identification with the direct commanding officer, compared with an established and respected leader. An unknown or discredited leader has much less chance of gaining compliance from soldiers in combat. Intensity of the authority figure's demands for killing behavior. The leader's mere presence is not always sufficient to ensure killing activity. The leader must also communicate a clear expectancy of killing behavior. When he does, the influence can be enormous. When Lieutenant Kelly first ordered his men to kill a group of women and children in the village of Milai, he said, "You know what to do with them," and left. When he came back, he asked, "Why haven't you killed them?" The soldier he confronted said, "I didn't think you wanted us to kill them." "No," Kelly responded, "I want them dead," and proceeded to fire at them himself. Only then was he able to get his soldiers to start shooting in this extraordinary circumstance in which the soldiers' resistance to killing was, understandably, very high. Legitimacy of the authority figure's authority and demands. Leaders with legitimate, societally sanctioned authority have greater influence on their soldiers, and legitimate, lawful demands are more likely to be obeyed than illegal or unanticipated demands. Gang leaders and mercenary commanders have to carefully work around their shortcomings in this area, but military officers, with their trappings of power and the legitimate authority of their nation behind them, have tremendous potential to cause their soldiers to overcome natural resistance and reluctance in combat. The Centurion Factor, the role of obedience in military history. The success of the Roman military machine can be seen in light of its mastery of leadership processes. The Romans pioneered the concepts of leadership development and the NCO Corps as we know it. And when the professional Roman army went up against the Greek citizen soldiers, leadership can be seen as a key factor in the Roman success. Both sides had the political legitimacy of their nations and city-states behind them, but there was a real difference in the military legitimacy that these leaders probably had in the eyes of their soldiers. The Roman centurion was a professional leader who had the respect of his soldiers because he had come up through the ranks and had previously demonstrated his ability in combat. This kind of legitimacy is completely different from that associated with leadership in civilian life, and the Greek leader was primarily a civilian whose peacetime legitimacy was not easily transferred to the battlefield and was often tainted by the spoils system and the petty politics associated with the local village he had come from. In the Greek phalanx, a leader at squad and platoon level was a spear-carrying member of the masses. The primary function of these leaders, as defined by their equipment and lack of mobility within the formation, was to participate in the killing. The Roman formation, on the other hand, had a series of mobile, highly trained, and carefully selected leaders whose primary job was not to kill, but to stand behind their men and demand that they kill. Many factors led to the military supremacy that permitted the Romans to conquer the world. For example, their volleys of cleverly designed javelins provided physical distance in the killing process, and their training enabled the individual to use the point and overcame the natural resistance to thrusting. But most authorities agreed that a key factor was the degree of professionalism in their small unit leaders, combined with a formation that facilitated the influence of these leaders. The influence of an obedience-demanding leader can also be observed in many of the killing circumstances seen in this book. It was the command, "That's got to be Charlie, you asshole. Blow their ass up and run," that spurred Steve Banco into killing a Viet Cong soldier. For John Barry Freeman, it was a pointed machine gun and the order, "Shoot the man," that caused him to shoot one of his fellow mercenaries who had been condemned to death. And for Alan Stewart Smythe, the screamed order, "Kill him, goddammit, kill him now," was necessary to bring him to kill a man who was in the process of swinging the muzzle of the weapon toward him. In these and many other killing circumstances, we can see that it was the demand for killing actions from a leader that was the decisive factor. Never underestimate the power of the need to obey. Our blood in his guts, the price the leader pays. In many combat situations, the ultimate mechanism that leads to defeat is when the leader of a group can no longer bring himself to demand sacrifice by his men. One of Bill Mauldin's famous World War II cartoons shows Willie and Joe discussing General Old Blood and Guts Patton. "Yeah," says the weary, disheveled combat soldier, "our blood and his guts." Although intended as sarcasm, There is a profound truth in this statement, for often it is the soldier's blood and the leader's guts that stave off defeat. And when the leader's guts or will to sacrifice his men gives out, then the force he is leading is defeated. This equation becomes particularly apparent in situations in which soldiers are cut off from higher authority. In these kind of situations, the leader is trapped with his men. He sees his soldiers dying. He sees the wounded suffering. There is no buffer of distance to enable any denial of the results of his actions. He has no contact with higher authority, and he knows that at any time he can end the horror by surrendering, and that the decision is solely his to make. As each of his men is wounded or killed, their suffering hangs on his conscience, and he knows that it is he and he alone who is making it continue. He and his will to accept the suffering of his men are all that keep the battle going. At some point, he can no longer bring himself to muster the will to fight, and with one short sentence, the horror is ended. Some leaders choose to fight to their death, taking their men with them in a blaze of glory. In many ways, it is easier for the leader if he can die quickly and cleanly with his men and need never live with what he has done. One of the most striking of such situations is that of Major James Devereux, the commander of the U.S. Marines defending Wake Island. The small Marine detachment at Wake held out against overwhelming Japanese forces from December 8th to December 22nd, 1941. The last message sent out before Devereux and his men were overwhelmed was received by radio telegraphy and said simply, "Send more Japs." But the price for the leader who has lived through such situations is high. He must answer to the widows and the orphans of his men, and he must live forevermore with what he has done to those who entrusted their lives to his care. When I interview combatants, many tell of their remorse and anguish that they have never told anyone of before. But I have not yet had any success at getting a leader to confront his emotions revolving around the soldiers who have died in combat as a result of his orders. In interviews, such men work around reservoirs of guilt and denial that appear to be too deeply buried to be tapped, and perhaps this is for the best. The Lost Battalion of World War I is a famous example of a unit that was sustained by its leader's will. This unit, a battalion of the 77th Division, was cut off and surrounded by Germans during an attack. They continued to fight for days. They ran out of food, water, and ammunition. The survivors were surrounded by friends and comrades suffering from horrible wounds that could not receive medical attention until they surrendered. The Germans brought up flamethrowers and tried to burn them out. Still, their commander would not surrender. They were not an elite or specially trained unit. They were only a composite infantry battalion made up of citizen soldiers in a National Guard division. Yet they performed a feat that will shine forever in the annals of military glory. All the survivors give full credit for their achievement to the incredible fortitude of their battalion commander, Major C.W. Whittlesey, who refused to surrender and constantly encouraged the dwindling survivors of his battalion to fight on. After 5 days, their battalion was rescued. Major Whittlesey was given the Congressional Medal of Honor. Many people know this story. What they don't know is that Whittlesey committed suicide shortly after the war.